not being recognized nationally by our government.
Okay, so we're just about out of time. Time to move on to our next program, Hour of the Wolf, with Jim Freund, so we can have a last comment, if you have a thought. Very brief.
Yeah, I just want to say, please come to Shift. It's going to be a great event. It's specifically for BAI-minded people. It's at 18 Whitwell Place on November 22nd, 1122. You just go to the website earthdriver.org, and the flyer is right there in the center of the page. So I'm inviting the BAI audience, and continue to support WBAI.
Okay, and your the email for people to find out more, Paulette, about your archiving of the material for Robert Knight is?
The email is thenightreport@gmail.com.
Okay, and I'm Catherine Davis. For those of you who would like to reach out to me, it's Catherine, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, Catherine, at heartofmind.org. I want to thank you for joining us this evening. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and oh yes, the imagination. Our guest this morning, Rajan Khanna. If you know the name, you know to stay tuned. If you don't know the name, trust me, you will. As I was saying, a little dead air never hurt anybody, as it were, but Kathy is showing me how to plug my bleeping key drive into the receptacle. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. So, what can I say? Wonderful seeing you, Kathy. In case you haven't noticed, I'm really easy on ceremony. People can talk and everything unless there's somebody reading. That's different. Okay, so we do have a review from Dan Persons, and I want to put that at the top and get it over with. But I will tell you that I edited it. Try saying that frequently. Edited it. And while I have not yet seen the movie in question, I think I agree with the review. It's something called Interstellar.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I saw Christopher Nolan's new film Interstellar at the Lincoln Square IMAX Theater here in New York City. That turned out to be a good call, seeing it at, as a staff member helpfully proclaimed before the film started, the second largest IMAX screen in the world. You want larger? You need to go to Australia. Interstellar on a genuinely big screen is an impressive, immersive experience. But interestingly, unlike Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity, whose entire reason for being was to envelop you in the experience, I don't feel it's essential to see Interstellar that way. And in some ways, that's how I feel about Interstellar overall. Not that it's impressive, but non-essential. That's a little too harsh. It is a very good film, but in terms of the stakes the film sets for itself and the science fiction classic it pays homage to in practically every frame, one just can't ignore the shortfall. And let's just say this right out. If Chris Nolan wasn't going around pointing out that his tale of a team of astronauts led by Matthew McConaughey and backed up by Anne Hathaway, who plunge into a wormhole to find a suitable planet for the survivors of a dying Earth, took its inspiration from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, among other films, it'd still be damn easy to tell. From the monolithic, wisecracking robots to a side trip to Saturn to its trippy finale to much, 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 much more, much, 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 much more, the cues are all there and pretty blatant. And I don't mind, because for all that Nolan does pretty much rub your nose in it, it doesn't really distract. Nolan pays homage while still making Interstellar his own, and I respect him for that. But it leaves me with the problem of evaluating the film without seeing it through the lens of the greatest science fiction film ever made. There, I said it. Anybody want to take me on? I'm going to try to do that eventually, but let me say this. There are two typical criticisms of Stanley Kubrick's science fiction epic. One is about its length and pacing. The other is that it's perceived as lacking, for want of a better term, heart. That latter knock is, I think, bourgeois. Not all heart can be measured in terms of a guy and a gal sharing a clinch at the fade-out. And how can a film in which humanity discovers there's something greater, more awesome, more mind-blowing than its own petty concerns be said to be lacking heart? As for the film's running length, well, time is very much a function of 2001's story and the deliberate pacing and expression of the film's themes of humanity finally confronting the vastness of an unbounded universe and the potential that may reside there. 2001 is an experiential tale. You live its themes as much as watch them. To his credit, Chris Nolan and his brother Jonathan, who co-wrote the script, fully appreciate this aspect of 2001 and actually double down on it. Time is a big theme of Interstellar, not just in the ticking clock of the survival of humankind, but in the way the physics of interdimensional space travel, the wormholes, the gravity wells, can warp one's experience of time, setting people, despite their shared goals, on very different paths, depending on which spaceship or planet they happen to be standing on. That aspect of time warping then leads directly into Interstellar's heart and its tale of McConaughey's struggle to return to his loving daughter, whom he leaves as a child and encounters over time and video transmissions as a fully grown woman played by Jessica Chastain. Yes, it's more conventional than 2001's contemplation of life, the universe, and everything, 42, but is in its own way a compelling way of bringing the awesome scale of Interstellar's themes down to a human perspective. Where Nolan's approach falters is in the film's trippy finale, which eschews Kubrick's confidence in an audience being able to piece together their own answers in favor of an overwrought, trans-dimensional confrontation stuffed with reams of exposition that both McConaughey and Chastain make the emotions credible despite the clunkiness is a credit to their skills as actors. That Nolan falters a bit in the clinch means that there was one lesson from the master that he maybe should have paid a little more attention to. Trust your audience to find their own way to your themes. It really isn't all that hard. But listen, to take on, out of love and respect, one of the signature achievements of science fiction cinema, and to come up with something that pays tribute and is still fully one's own, is nothing to sneeze at. At close to 3 hours, you do feel the burden of Interstellar's running time, but all told, it's an amazing, thrilling, and intelligent adventure with, surprise, surprise, more heart than one usually encounters with a Nolan film. It is quite an achievement among Nolan's best. I'm Dan Persons. We are archiving these reviews over at MightyMoviePodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out CineFantastic Online over at CFQOnline.com.
Thank you, Dan. I have no problems with Dan's assertion that 2001 A Space Odyssey is the best science fiction film ever. And I can say that because Matt Kressel is not in this room. If he were, there would be fisticuffs over that versus Blade Runner.
Yes, definitely. It'd be a duel, perhaps.
Yeah, but what do they have in common? He saw Blade Runner when he was about 13. I saw 2001 when I was about 13.
I think I'm with you, though, and I didn't see it until it was much later. So.
Yeah. And, and the other thing is, yes, 2001 is a cold movie. Every movie by Stanley Kubrick is a cold movie. What warmth do you get out of Dr. Strangelove or from Barry Lyndon or from Full Metal Jacket. He is a cold, cold director. If you want to see, and then we better deal with our guests. If you want to see a movie that is a response, a direct response to 2001, that has heart and heat, but respects and reviles 2001 as a director, Andrei Tarkovsky's brilliant film, Solaris, which he made because he said, that movie is cold, Stanislav Lem, and my movie will be warm. He takes the same love in showing, like, trees passing as our lead characters driving to the spaceport for 5 minutes, just as long as Kubrick has a ship in cold space. He's going through trees and watching people in Moscow and stuff like that. It is... and then the drama that takes place over a planet with a sentient ocean that is doing amazing things. That's all about warmth and love and hate. It is as emotional as Kubrick is disattached, unemotional. And they are both valid, both good. So everybody who's charging, oh, Kubrick's a cold director. Yes. That's right. Next topic. With us, as mentioned before, is Rajan. I got it correct this time. Yes?
Close.
Uh-oh.
It's Rajan.
It's Rajan. It's Rajan. Jeez. I call him Raj.
Yeah, everyone calls me Raj.
But now it's a byline.
That's true.
That's the difference. When you're on the show, either as a member of Altered Fluid or...
I think it's always been Altered
Fluid.
It's always been Altered Fluid so far?
Okay, well, then. And then we're breaking a tradition here. Very good. Which I'm so happy to do as more and more Fluidians are emerging with novels. We'll have another one in 2 weeks. Her novel isn't new. It's a trilogy, but for the first time, the entire trilogy is put together in one really nice volume by Orbit Books, with just to screw everybody up. With me, fine, it's a review copy. But for you, you got to buy this, even if you already have the Inheritance Trilogy by N.K. Jemisin. That's Jemisin. There's something I always got wrong also. I'd always say S-O-N and then duck when Nora would just like, no! A new novella thrown in so that even if you have the book, I have the book, I have the audio book, and on this show in 2 weeks, we'll have Nora.
See, my recommendation would be buy the new volume so you get to read the novella and then give the old copies you have to your friends so that they can enjoy
them as well. I can't. They're autographed to me.
Oh, well, then you can't.
I can't. These are treasures. Oh, more than that, when the first book, The 100,000 Kingdoms, came out, there was some event that Tempest Bradford, another Fluidian, was holding at Blue Stockings. I don't remember exactly what the event was, but... I had just gotten my review copy, which was actually not an arc, but a final of Nora's first novel. And she was already there, and I was there. We were both there like 90 minutes before the event. And I showed the book to her. She had her copy. I had my copy. Nobody else seemed to have copies yet, except maybe some reviewers here and there. Locust probably had a copy. Right. But I got the first autograph.
That's
pretty impressive. Nora ever gave out. Now, it doesn't say on it, first autograph certified. But to me, that's ego boo.
It is kind of special the first time somebody comes up to you and asks for your autograph for your first novel.
Did this start happening for you?
The
novel Falling Sky?
Falling Sky, yeah. It just happened.
Falling. You see, now I did it wrong again. Jeez.
Unfortunately, with both my name and the title of the book, it's easy to mix it up. This past weekend...
See, I just got an e-copy of it. I don't have a physical...
This past
weekend...
Well, later,
yes.
I was in in D.C. or the D.C. area for the World Fantasy Convention, and they do they have a signing event where basically everyone who's there gets to sit down and people come in. So a young woman came up to me and asked me to sign it, and that was my first non-friend signing, because I've had, you know, at the book launch party, I had friends come up to me and I made, you know, little inscriptions.
Launch party I missed. I missed the one for Elia Don Johnson tonight.
Oh, yeah. Which
was this great. Elia Don Johnson or Elia
Don Johnson?
Johnson.
Yeah.
Because she uses both.
Elia Don Johnson.
Okay.
I have the book in my bag right now, Love is the Drug. So, yeah. We're both of our books have pandemics in them, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, God.
I know, it's a bad time for that.
Well, in fact, Elia, rhymes with papaya, Elia was interviewed not that long ago on NPR about pandemics, and she talked a little bit about, you know, with the whole Ebola crisis. And she talked a little bit about that, and she talked also about Connie Willis's book Blackout, which
right.
finishes her time Oxford time travel series, which again Matt and I are at odds on.
Yeah, I'm actually finishing that up as we speak, so no
oh,
spoilers.
Really?
Yeah.
But did you like the first two books?
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite is Connie was one of my teachers at Clarion West in 2008.
Let's see if we match our favorites.
My favorite of her, especially, and it's a time travel book too, is To Say Nothing of the Dog.
Thank you.
Yes. I read that.
We match.
Yeah, I read it before I went, and it was recommended to me as like, you know, if you read one book, read this. And I think that.
That's what
novel,
I did. I read that, then I went backwards and read the Doomsday
yeah.
book.
But
reread To Say Nothing of the Dog.
I think it's such a well-crafted book. Like it's, and it has to be because of all the time travel shenanigans that go on in it, but it's. I finished the book and I was like, wow, that was exceptionally done. So
yeah,
yeah.
At the end of the book you are now reading, which is actually published in two volumes
right.
Because it is that thick. She wrote it as one book.
Right,
that was always her intent. But as this one book is longer than the first two put together. And again, the crafting is so wonderful and so great. And when it had just come out, and she was the guest of honor at Capclave, and I got to do the guest of honor interview.
Oh, right.
Twice now I got to do the guest of honor this year. Somebody named Genevieve Valentine, something like that. I have to broadcast that. That's right. Problem is that I was going to broadcast her reading from KGB last month,
right.
and the recorder failed on poor Gordon Linsner.
That's too bad.
And I'm not going to be able to get Genevieve's attention till sometime next year.
Well, she's busy writing comics now.
Catwoman,
yeah.
Another novel, and stuff you can't talk about, which is all very thrilling.
I remember, I think I can say this, it was a couple years ago, I just found an agent, and I sat down with her briefly, and I asked, you know, I was asking how she's planning things and what she wants to do, and she laid out this, this list of, I don't know, maybe 15 projects that she was already planning on doing, and I guess she's just, I mean, I assume she's going down the list, or at least coming up with new things, so.
Yep.
But that I remember thinking, oh, okay. You know, I have like a ton of stuff I want to do too. I guess it's possible to do that. So
yeah, and you and Genevieve have the same agent.
Yes,
it so happens, and both the same former agent, who's now a publisher.
Yes, or he's an editor now. Yeah,
he's an editor now and a former curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Yeah.
And Joe, you and I have to have words over an incident 2 years ago. And then I'll tell you off the air.
Okay.
But anyway, so this is thrilling.
It's pretty exciting. It's you know, I'm sure lots of people have talked about this, but, you know, you look forward to something like this for a long period of time, and then it comes, and it's this big explosion, and then afterwards... things seem a little weird because, you know, obviously something huge has changed in your career, and there's still this, you know, like, obviously I'm hoping people will still buy the book and enjoy it, but I liken it also to when I was a kid. And
the publisher, speaking of your former agent.
Oh, well, my publisher is Pyre Books, and...
it's Pyre!
Yeah.
Why the bleep didn't Pyre send me a copy?
I don't know.
They send me all their books.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Lisa Michalski.
Although she did go out on maternity leave, so maybe...
That's right! That's why I didn't get it. The darned baby. Pyre, by the way, PYR, right, is a very interesting company. They're part of Prometheus Books,
right,
which is a progressive, very politically progressive publisher. And some of that, not all of that, is reflected in Pyre Books, which is a very good imprint in science fiction. And the editor is Lou Anders.
Lou Anders is my editor, and I mean, this book would not be what it is without his help.
And he's one of the grand editors now that Fred Pohl is gone there.
Yeah, although, I don't know if you know this, he actually left Pyre as an editor. He stepped down because he just put out a middle grade book, and it's part of a series that he is now, you know, he's in love with writing books now, so he's out being a writer. So I joke that this... over the course of this book, my agent quit to take a dream job as an editor, and my editor quit to take a dream job as a writer.
And what's Joe's company at Simon & Schuster?
The imprint's called Saga.
That's it, yeah. Saga, yeah.
So at first I thought, oh no, is this a cursed book? But then I like to think it inspires people to chase their dreams.
It's think of it as a transitional book.
Right, exactly.
It has transitioned you into a published novelist.
That's true.
It transitioned Lou Anders from being one of the better editors out there into writing middle grade stuff, which is quite the market.
Although I assume he was writing middle grade before I came along, but I mean, he's, you know, he's enjoying
It happened during the tenure of your book. And Lisa had a baby, so that's certainly transitional.
Yeah.
Especially for the baby.
I had nothing to do with that part. So.
No, not at all. Not at all. But, so you have to look at it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's been really exciting. You know, it gives you a taste of, now that one book's out, you know, I'm looking forward to many more, hopefully. So
yes.
We'll see.
So, yes, I'm pleased that it's Pyre, because they don't... for some reason, they don't get a lot of credit when people talk about some of the things. But I've had a few, John Sprunk and Susan and Clay Griffiths.
Right.
Did both did an Hour of the Wolf and a New York Review of Science Fiction reading with Margot Adler. Because she was on her vampire fetish.
Oh, right. Okay.
Is in the middle of her vampire fetish.
Yeah, and E.C. Myers, who's in my writing group as well, I mean, he published two books with them, so it was nice when...
That's right.
...when I started working with them that, you know, he had been through things before, so with Faircoin and Quantum Coin, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a third book in that?
These
things often come in threes, although Coins only have two sides.
Coins only have two... I can't answer for him, but I, as far as I know, there was just the two books.
Since I last had him on the show, only since then have I read Edgar Eger, and one of his books is all about a magical coin, and I was wondering if there was... Eger took from E. Nesbitt.
Huh.
And people should be taking from Eger. And, you know, young people with magical coins that have abilities.
Right. Yeah.
You know, beyond that, there's no similarity.
Right,
but
right.
I think there's a tradition.
Huh. That's cool. While I'm plugging people's books, his new book just came out, The Silence of Six, E.C. Myers.
Now, that I didn't know. And who published that? Eugene... Eugene C. Myers, if you are listening, get out of Philadelphia and come do a show.
Well, he just had a baby, so I think he's busy right now.
Well, his wife just...
Well, I mean, yeah.
How's this? I can go to Philadelphia and record you. Philadelphia isn't that far.
I don't, so unfortunately, know the publisher offhand, but it just came out. It's a, like, conspiracy novel, so... And I haven't read it
yet. So it's very different from...
Yeah, it's non-genre, really, so...
Yeah, although it should appeal to a similar audience, I would think.
Yeah, it's funny because I mostly write science fiction and fantasy, and I mostly read science fiction and fantasy, but, you know, if I wrote a mystery story, I don't stop to think, oh, this is so different. You know, it just feels like one more thing that the people are into, so...
So let's talk about you. What got you into Skiffy to begin with? What were you reading that made you say, or watching, that made you say, this is cool, I want to do this?
Huh. That's actually a good question, because I can't remember a time that I wasn't interested in it. I mean, the earliest books, I think the first books that I can recall that I fell in love with at a young age and used to beg my mother to take me back to the library to take out were the Oz books. So, you know, they're full of fantasy, and I think that was what drew me to them, just, you know, this crazy world of, you know, talking animals and, you know, all the magical
and
creations.
They're very, very, people think of Oz as family stuff and kid stuff, but in fact it's very sophisticated and very sly.
Sure.
Political satire.
Yeah, and I probably
Gregory Maguire stuff is.
Right. And I didn't get a lot of that, I'm sure, but like I remember, you know, there was a whole shelf full of, you know, really nice copies of those books, and I would just go in and take the next one out and then take the next one out, and then after, you know, at the same time it was C.S. Lewis and it was, you know, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, and it kind of snowballed because, you know, at that time Dungeons and Dragons was big and I would play that with all my friends, so it just became, and of course, you know, on the other side you had Star Wars and all those influences, so I never really had a choice, it feels like, in the sense that I found something I loved at an early age, and I was always from then on reading science fiction and fantasy, and it wasn't actually until maybe I was about 13, once Dungeons and Dragons came about, like I was just reading Dungeons and Dragons books for like years and years and years, and it wasn't until I was about 13 that I was drawn out into the rest of the bookshelf.
Despite the fact that those were marketing tie-ins, some of those are actually not bad at all.
Sure. And I mean, you know, like the Dragonlance books back then, those were a big deal.
And they had spin-off novels from spin-off novels, and they created rather rich universe. Wizards of the Coast, was it?
I think back then it was still TSR before Wizards bought them.
Was TSR actually doing books?
Yeah, they had an imprint for a little while, and I think part of what made me move on also was that they did end up spinning off so much from the main novels that I wasn't as interested in some of the stories. I mean, you know, nothing against them, but sometimes I think there was once, you know, like based on the Dragonlance books, they would go back and then fill in some backstory, and I remember reading one and thinking, wow, that's not as grand or epic as I kind of imagined it in my mind. So like, I almost wish they hadn't gone back and done that. But what, you know, whatever. But I moved on.
But I think that also shows the mind of a future writer, the very comment that you were making that and saying, I could have made that better.
I don't even know if it was that or if it was like,
I'm imprinting on you.
No, that's fine. But I don't know if I had this, you know, this thought back then. But sometimes, you know, if you hint enough, the reader will fill in something or at least get an impression of something, you know, huge and crazy, and you could never quite capture it. And when you try to, it doesn't always live up to what they had in mind. So I think, you know, knowing when to tell and when not to tell, I think is actually an interesting question. And of course, you know, there's probably, you know, tons of fans out there who are desperate to have that story told, you know, so sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it also, I think I noticed that the authors who wrote the original stories were not the authors who were writing these spin-off stories. And so I was always, you know, for right or wrong reasons.
They probably had different editors also.
Yeah, I was less interested in the ones that I felt like deviated from the original vision at the time. Much in the same way that, you know, sometimes these days, and again, I'm not knocking the people who like these or that they exist, but sometimes, you know, they'll bring in a later writer to write something that, you know, after someone has died or after, you know, someone
has
moved on.
Well, I just did an interview on Monday, 2 days ago, with Eric Van Lustbader.
Yeah.
Who took over the Jason Bourne books.
Okay, right.
From Robert Ludlum. Right. Now, he was at least good friends with Ludlum, and they shared an agent and stuff like that. So, and there are those who would argue that Eric's Jason Bourne is very different from the Ludlum.
Right.
But he made it his own. He never tried to imitate.
Right. Well, yeah, and I think, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you hear that with actors sometimes too. If they try to imitate the person who did it before them, then you become just kind of a pale shadow, whereas you have to kind of inhabit it yourself.
Well, I worked on the off-Broadway production of Torch Song Trilogy.
Okay.
And, you know, nobody can replace Harvey Fierstein.
Right.
But Harvey Fierstein had to go to L.A., and the bus and truck companies and all that. And who do you get to replace that voice?
Right, exactly.
You know, and my choice was Tim Curry.
Okay.
Who would have been, and not the Dr. Frankenfurter Tim Curry, but the brought two-time Tony Award-winning.
Right. I mean, he's a really versatile guy.
Oh, he's a brilliant actor. He's a brilliant actor. My favorite thing of his was in Travesties.
Okay.
Where he played Tristan Tzara, the Dada artist, who, as told by a man who keeps getting Lennon and Oscar Wilde and James Joyce confused. James Joyce was directing a production of The Importance of Being Earnest at the time that Lennon was preparing in Switzerland to write his speech. And there was really a guy who was this dignitary in Zurich at the time. And the story is told by this guy when he's senile.
Oh, wow.
And so he's conflating the point where there are two secretaries and they become characters out of earnest.
Oh, wow.
And Tim Curry was Tristan Tzara in this madcap, brilliant Tom Stoppard play.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
And he was the lead in Amadeus.
Okay.
So, yeah, he's quite an actor. And, yeah, and there's the problem. So when Tim Curry left Amadeus, you didn't want somebody coming in and doing Tim Curry. If somebody else comes in and does Rocky Horror, you don't need them to do, oh, Rocky! Right. You know, and all of that. You need their own interpretation. Oh, and the other case I was thinking of is, of course, when Brandon Sanderson.
Oh, right, with The Wheel of Time.
There's a classic example where he took over for Robert Jordan in The Wheel of Time books.
And I mean, that, I think that's an interesting example because, you know, that series was left unfinished, and you know, and you know, from what I've heard, there were plenty of notes, and the story had been communicated to people what it was supposed to be. But I mean, like for example, the Chronicles of Amber are, you know, in my top three, you know, books of all time. Like they're by Roger Zelazny.
Just reread.
Sorry? Oh, you just reread.
Yeah. I just reread all 10 books, although they were supposed to be 6 books and not 10.
Oh, I didn't know that. But
I did a 6-hour interview once with Roger Zelazny that I don't have a copy
of. Oh, I'm so jealous. He's one of my heroes that I never got a chance to meet because he died.
I stayed at his house. There was a Worldcon was in Australia somewhere in the 70s, and the NASFIC, the replacement for Worldcon in North America, was in San Diego.
Okay.
So he held a non-con in Baltimore. This is before he moved to, I guess, New Mexico.
Yeah, I think it was around there.
But to the Southwest for his health. And about 20 of us slept on the floor of his house.
Wow.
With his little kitten named Greased Lightning. That's what I remember the most. And Roger is just one of the nicest people. And he came, and he was like, well, we don't have guest of honor, so let me read Death and the Executioner, scene from Lord of Light.
Wow.
And Lord of Light is one of my...
That's...
Also
great.
Amber has, as far as fantasy epics are concerned, Amber is up there with the greats. But for... among my favorite books, period, genre, non-genre, whatever, Lord of Light.
Yeah, Lord of Light's amazing, too.
I'm waiting for the movie, damn it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they can finally do it now.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
I even know who the director should be and all that. Andrew Stanton, using the same kind of technology that he used in John Carter.
Oh, right, yeah. Huh.
Which
would be cool.
I mean, which is basically Pixar technology.
Right.
So imagine that with the themes in there. And for those who don't know, by the way, the movie Argo.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean the movie starring Ben Affleck, but the movie that Tony Mendez, the guy who Ben Affleck played... That movie was Lord of Light.
Right, exactly.
Argo was a horrid, horrid screenplay that had everybody's fingerprints on it, including Bradbury.
Huh.
And Ray Harryhausen.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Those another two of my heroes. So.
That was Argo. And Jack Kirby, of course, did those
illustrations.
Art, right, yeah. And somebody's actually making a documentary film about Lord of Light and Argo and that the science fiction theme park. Pardon me for a moment while I open the door. A science fiction theme park that was to be based on all that.
Just the fact that when
Buster is here, by the way.
When I heard about the confluence of all those different people and this kind of scheme that was going on, I mean, that blows my mind because, you know, Jack Kirby and Roger Zelazny and all these people, I mean, that's kind of...
Zelazny had nothing to do with it.
But, I mean, you know, it's based on, I guess...
I mean, the poor man's Demolition Alley is about all that he got to see in terms of movies
based
on his work. At least he got to see The Last Defender of Camelot, which was a short story of his done on the new Twilight Zone as written and produced by some guy named George R.R. Martin. I don't know what happened to him.
He probably faded into obscurity somewhere.
Yeah, went off to Camelot. I think he owns it now. He can afford it.
Yeah. I guess just my original point in bringing Zelazny up in the first place.
Yes.
No, it was just that I know that they did... The state authorized at least one book in what was supposed to be a prequel series, and I think Robin Wayne Bailey was the author of that. And it's nothing against that book because I never read it, but it was just, you know, like, I'm happy with this Zelazny books, and I had, you know, that's good enough for me. And that's not.
And they're
like,
so extensive.
Yeah,
there's a lot that one can do with that universe, and why.
Although, I mean,
unless your name is not even Trent Zelazny, but Roger Zelazny.
And apparently he didn't want other people, because there's, I guess, you know, again, this is all apocryphal, so I've never actually talked to Neil Gaiman or Stephen Bruce, but they had apparently approached him because they were both big fans and asked if they could put together an anthology or something about them writing in the Amber universe. And he said, you know, this is my baby and I want to keep it to myself, which is, you know, fine. I feel like... there are certain projects that are just like that. And then there are others like, you know, George R.R. Martin's Wild Card series, for example, which are meant to be, you know, please come and play in this universe. And
he did that with Gardner Does Why, I think, initially?
I don't know. But, I mean, I know that he's been
involved.
I know
the latest one is George and Gardner.
Okay. I read those also when I was a kid, too. I mean, just, you know, all the amazing
authors. I'm groaning because I had George on when they were new, and I remember, you know, so it's like, when you're a kid, you millennials. Are you a millennial? What's a millennial?
I don't know what a millennial is. I'm 40, so I don't know where that places me at this point.
Yeah, no, I know. Oh dear. I think you're a generation.
I'm older than a millennial.
You're closer to Gen X or.
Yeah, somebody told me tonight that I'm technically Gen X, but I never thought I was, so I don't know.
Well, thank God you don't have, I mean, Gen X stood for a certain attitude that was awful.
But I'm not a baby boomer, so I don't know.
No, I'm a boomer.
Right.
I'm 1953. I'm a boomer. I'm 60. So I'm at the young end of the boomers. What, Lister? I hope the radio audience can all see this guy with his sly cat-like smile smirking.
Meow.
Our studio audience is here. Oh, this is Rajan. This is Lister.
Nice to meet you.
And by the way, when I introduced Matt to Lister, I said, this is Lister. Matt just got Red Dwarf.
Oh, Red Dwarf, yeah, of course.
You know, he just... You're aware of that significance.
Oh, great.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay, good. Anyway, how long is your reading going to be, by the way? You're going to do for us now, because we actually have to watch the clock.
You tell me.
Well, it's now 2:14. I don't know. Are you thinking opening segment? Is there?
I was probably going to read the opening part. Yeah, I mean, I can read the first few sections. It's really quick, so.
Yeah. Okay.
If I go too far, just let me know.
Okay. Well, I can always do. You know, that
yeah.
Kind of
signal
things.
Me secretly
yeah,
over
and
the
that,
radio.
And that means within 2 or 3 minutes. It doesn't mean stop right then. But did you want to finish your point before you start reading? And do you want to take a break before you start reading?
I don't need a break. I mean, I guess I don't even remember what my point was. I think it was just, you know, the
well,
stuff.
I had interrupted, but the question was, you know, the books that inspired you.
Yeah, I mean, as I think it's I've gone through several shifts. I mean, obviously, like I said, the Amber books were something that I discovered in college, and when I found them, I was in love just because of the voice and because of the you know, blending of different elements of noir and there was a bit of swagger and just all the ideas, things like that. And I guess that was a big influence. I mean, with this book, it's definitely at least partially an influence on this book just because it's first person. And, you know, Zelazny was always my roadmap for how to do first person really well.
Oh, he was brilliant at that.
Yeah. And so I think there's a little bit of that.
And it's wonderful that Zelazny had a way of having that first person do self-discovery.
Yeah.
So yeah. That as the character develops, that character, usually he...
Sure.
It's getting the development at the same time we are. The revelation is for all.
Yeah, I was always a bit jealous.
Oh, and by the way, for anybody who wants to start on the Amber Chronicles, the first book is The Nine Princes of Amber.
Right.
Although it's pretty easy, especially in e-format, to get the entire Chronicles in one, not that expensive, almost sadly, not that expensive volume.
Yeah, in print, I think it's only available now as an omnibus. But they're short books, so you can read them. Like the first five are probably like one.
You gobble them.
You know, less than one Martin book. You know,
you can't say page turner anymore, can you? They're volume button clickers.
Okay.
or screen swipers.
Yeah.
You don't have a page.
Well, some people use actual pages, so, you know.
Yeah, so I suppose that's always a good thing.
Or quick flickers, maybe, I don't know.
Ooh, I like that, quick flickers, yes. But they'll just say page turners, because people still dial their smartphones.
That's true.
They've probably never seen a dial in their life.
Though I have. Yeah, I've seen rotary phones, even, but,
yeah. Yeah. But,
well, you're just depressing me and making me feel old, Jim.
Oh. Don't get me started. I turned 60 this year. I'm going to be 61 next month.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And I've been working here since I was 13, so talk about feeling old.
Wow. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I mean, you know, when I started at WBAI, the people I was working with were, oh my God, Chip Delaney,
yeah,
Baird Searles,
wow,
Theodore Sturgeon, Tom Dish, and Joanna Russ.
And very impressive.
Of those, one is alive.
Oh.
And he'll be reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings in April. He and Sam Miller.
Oh, I know Sam.
Yeah, so it will be, okay, I had to do it. It's just another bad joke of mine. It's Sam Enchanted Evening.
Oh, boy.
And quick story, and then you can do your reading.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But I had Delaney on. He was my first boss at BAI. He's a staff member here.
Right.
Something people don't recall, but damn it, we had Delaney working with us, I should say, producing great radio drama, The Star Pit.
Right.
Anyway, I had Delaney on my show 5 to 7 a.m. one morning, and Jeff Greenfield, later of CBS and Channel 13 and a pundit, but at that time was out of National Lampoon and various things, was doing a 7 to 9 a.m. show that I engineered. And I had Delaney on. And Jeff comes in at like 5 minutes before 7, takes a look, sees Delaney sitting there, and he says, "Sammy! Bronx High School of Science."
Oh, wow.
There was this one class where like half of the geniuses of the world were on that class. But I know Chip Delaney. I know Samuel R. Delaney. I've even occasionally, rarely, heard somebody refer to him as Sam. But Sammy? And Chip was just like, oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You'll get to meet Chip. He's going to be on. Actually, I may have to record him because he, on April 1st, will be 74. So I have to respect that. Why should I respect that? I'm 61. Screw it, Chip. I might as well, since I'm mentioning the series, December 2nd will be the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. KGB is this coming Wednesday at the KGB Bar, KGB Fantastic Fiction. And, ooh, do you remember who's reading? It's always
right
good.
Yeah.
So people should just go.
I totally forgot.
No matter what. But, I'll look it up and I'll tell people. But we have our family night where a family does the reading. And the family, as always in December, is Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. Last year, we turned away about 40 or 50 people.
Wow.
Because they did an entire audiobook thing there that was with all these stars. All these audiobook narrators, famous, famous people.
No room at the inn, I guess, huh?
Yeah, something like that, doing Swords Point.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, so we were turning away people at the gallery. But this one will be at 388 Atlantic Avenue because we are not able to use the Soho Gallery during December because it's now an artisan's market.
I see.
And they're using both floors. But also, Ellen and Delia have a habit of bringing in a large audience. And we had Walter Mosley and Paul DiFilippo there 2 months ago, and it was a great experience. And the only problem with that space is that there's this stupid radio station management on the third. Wonderful, wonderful. Mario and Berthold, wonderful management on the third floor of that building. So that's why listeners to WBAI may be familiar. BAI is in that same building. But the ground floor is where the Brecht Forum was. It's gorgeous, gorgeous space being renovated so that it will always have live stream running.
That's great.
And stuff like that. That's very cool.
By the way, I do know who's reading at KGB in December because it's Stephen Gould and myself. So December 17th, I'll put in a shameless plug for that.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Cool.
But yeah.
And Stephen Gould is a wonderful reader.
Yeah, I haven't actually heard him read, but I've met him a few times now, and he's great.
Yeah, no, he's been on the show twice before he was president of Science Fiction Writers of America, a job at which I think he's doing very well. Somebody's texting me. And So I'll have to look up who's this month.
Right, yeah.
But it's you and Steve Gould next month.
In December.
And then in February, I have... January, I have Daniel Jose Older.
Oh, great.
And Sarah Pinsker.
Great.
And then February, I have Jennifer Marie Brissett and a player to be named later.
Huh.
But that player has been asked. March, I'm playing around with. And April is Samuel R. Delaney and Sam J. Miller.
Great.
So I'm pleased with my lineup. But the KGB lineup is fab as well. And do you remember the December 17th, was it?
December 17th. I checked it earlier today.
Okay, good, so. Good. It's hard for me to make it there to do an event.
Yeah.
That takes energy and stuff, starting at 6. I mean, it starts at 7. But
right, you got to get
six.
In. Right.
And then do this radio show.
Oh, have to get that's the car. Right, because it's Wednesday. Yeah.
That's why I'm not at KGB anymore. Gordon Lindsner records it. And now they're putting those recordings on their website, something I've been threatening to do for years and haven't gotten around to. So Matt Kressel just went ahead and they're doing it, which is great. Sniff. Am I jealous? Well, yeah, but it's only because I was promising it for years and never got around to it, so who am I to complain? I would love to hear you read.
Okay.
I'm just babbling, I'm sorry.
That's
been a long day doing your job.
My job?
Yes, editing Lightspeed.
Oh, well, my old job.
Your old job, then you became a writer, you see? There was another transitional thing. And narrator.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally I still do some narrations. It's fun. I enjoy it.
Yeah, but there was a point when you were thinking of that as a regular gig.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'd still like to continue to do it. It's, you know, I just prefer
people
doing...
People listening on the radio, take note.
I prefer doing the reading and not so much all the editing and stuff. I mean, I can do that, but,
hey,
you know...
I'll do the editing.
All right.
I love doing the editing.
You know, I've flirted with the idea of doing a podcast, but, you know, it's just extra work. And anything that takes away from the writing sometimes is hard to justify, so...
Yeah, starting a podcast is tough. I've been starting it for about 4 years now.
And, I mean, recording and... I mean, well, coming up with content is... you know, not easy, but then the recording part I can do, but then it's the getting it out there and putting it through iTunes and putting all the descriptions.
Distribution and all that, yeah.
So if I could, you know, if I had someone who would do that with me, I'd be great.
Oh, well, you should talk. Because that's something I'm, you know, transitioning toward.
Okay.
So, be a great way for me to learn exactly all the iTunes and other RSS feed,
right?
Places.
Exactly.
I'm a non-Apple person. I have no Apple software on my computer or my phone,
right.
And so I use alternate sources. Not that, you know, people shouldn't use those other things, but
on the other hand, there are plenty of amazing podcasts out there at the moment. So I just listen to them or bully them into letting me on. So
there you go. So is there anything we should know about Falling Sky?
Before I start?
Yeah.
You know, I'm starting from the beginning, so I think, you know...
So actually, that should...
It should be fine, but I guess to give a short summary, I mean, it takes place in the future after a global pandemic, and that's pretty much, I think, all you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
So should I start?
Yeah.
All right. This is Chapter 1 of Falling Sky. It's when I hit the ground that my skin starts to itch, as if I can catch the bug from the very earth itself. I know I can't, but I itch anyway, and the sweat starts trickling, which doesn't help. But there's no time to focus on any of that now, because I'm on the ground, and there's nothing safe about that. So I heft the rifle in my hands, trying not to hold it too lightly, trying to feel a bit casual with its weight, but the kind of casual that makes it easy to shoot. And then Miranda is next to me. She gives me that half-smile, that almost mocking look she always does, and I see the sun reflected in her glasses. Then she's off, moving quickly to the prone form in the nearby clearing, the filthy, long-nailed mess I dropped just minutes ago with a trank gun. The effing feral. It's laid out in the grass, head lolling to the side, not moving. Just the way I like them. Its hair is a tangled mess merging into its beard. Figures, lone hunters are usually male. It wears a faded collared shirt so matted with dirt and muck that you can't tell what color it might have originally been. Its pants are tatters. And the stench. I always wonder how Miranda can stand it. There's nothing about it that says who he might have been before. Someone's brother? A father? A son? All swept away by the bug. It occurs to me that if my dad were alive, he would be telling me how truly effed this is. He was the one who taught me to run away from the things, to keep to the air. But my dad isn't around. Not anymore. And he'd be one to talk anyway. As Miranda bends over the feral, I catch sight of the pistol hanging from her belt in the makeshift holster. I gave her that pistol. Not that I ever want to see her have to use it. Especially not with the ammo supply being what it is, but she has one, and that's at least one smart change I've made. The others, I'm still deciding. My heart picks up in my chest the closer she gets to him. But that's not the worst part. He's out and will be out for hours, most likely, with the dose I hit him with. He's not going to wake up and grab her. No, what I'm afraid of comes next. Miranda pulls out the syringe. My breath almost stops. She's got the gloves on, the mask, and only the skin around her eyes is visible to me. Another smart change I've made to the process. But we're talking blood here. Feral blood. And if my dad taught me to run away from ferals, he taught me to fly away from their blood. Because that's how the bug is transmitted. By fluids. And if Miranda were to swallow, or maybe even inhale, just a little bit of that bugged-up plasma, well, there'll be one more feral in the world. And while Miranda pisses me the F off on a regular basis, I'd hate to see her go like that. She has the syringe in his arm, and the blood glugs out into a tube. You'd be surprised at how few test tubes there are in the world, but then again, maybe not. Just a moment more, and we're done, and Miranda will head back to the airship ladder, and I'll follow, making sure I give her a wide berth. I'm getting antsy, feet ready to move when I hear the first screams. The rifle raises in my hands almost of its own accord as I scan beyond her for the pack. Miranda, I call. Almost there. Now, I say. I can see the shapes moving down the next hill, ferals loping over the grass in tattered clothing. Their howls echo across the space between us. Miranda still isn't up. Then yelps come from behind me. Now, I roar as another pack comes from the other direction, this one larger and closer. The rifle kicks back in my hands, and gunshots punctuate their screams. I don't worry about where they came from, why I didn't see them. I breathe in, set up a shot, take it. Breathe out. Even after all these years, part of my body wants to jerk the trigger wildly, pepper the whole area with gunfire. But I don't have the ammo for that, and I can't afford to reload. And I've learned to control that part of me, learned to push it into some dark corner of the soul, or something. The rifle bucks. One feral goes down in a spray of blood that sends a chill through me. Another's face explodes in a wet mess. Miranda runs by me, careful to stay out of my line of fire, and I smell that elusive scent of hers. Then she's climbing up the ladder, and after another two shots, I'm right behind her. I try not to think about the vial of blood she's holding. Try not to think about it falling on me, somehow breaking. I try, and I fail. A feral reaches the bottom of the ladder, and we're still not up to the ship. I hook my arm around the rope and do the same for my leg, and I slowly aim and fire down on the thing's head. Then we're up and moving away, Miranda at the controls of the cherub, and the feel of the wind on my face, meters above the ground, is like a kiss. Making sure the rifle is secured, I climb the rest of the way to the gondola. The thing you have to understand for this all to make sense is that Miranda's a little crazy. Back in the clean, they would have called her idealistic. But back in the clean, idealistic wouldn't have gotten you killed. Or maybe it would. I've never been too good at history. Miranda's crazy because she thinks she can cure the bug. Not all by herself, of course. She has a lot of other scientist buddies working on it, too. But they all believe that one day they can wipe the bug from the surface of the planet. That one day, even, they can reverse it for all the ferals down on the ground. Me, I have my doubts. which begs the question, why am I even here in the first place? Why sign up with this lot when I just know they're going to fail? Well, I guess sometimes you just have to pick a side. And this is the one that makes me feel the least dirty. But still, all that blood. I met Miranda while I was foraging in Old Monterey. She'd been bagging ferals on her own back then. Some ship captain she'd hired had bailed on her, leaving her stranded with a pack of hostile ferals. I helped get her out. She offered me a job, flying her around, keeping an eye on her while she was in the field. At first I said no. Like I said, all that blood. Then Gastown happened, and I saw the path the world was heading down. Miranda's path seemed somehow better. So I changed my answer to yes. Luckily, Miranda's offers last longer than mine. That good? More?
More.
Okay. Back on board the Cherub, Miranda collapses into my comfy chair. Thank you, she says, like she always does after one of these jobs, looking up at me from under her glasses, the way that usually makes me feel strong and brave and something of a protector, and that usually diffuses any anger I might be feeling. I feel the anger slip, but I grab hold of it and pull it right back to me. This isn't a game. She raises her eyebrows. I know that. I don't think you do. I needed to get the whole sample. She sets her jaw. You know how this works. I made my rules clear when you hired me for this job, I say. You hired me to keep you safe. I can't do that when you don't listen to me. I do. If you lose a sample, it sets us back a bit, I'm aware. But if you get infected, this whole thing is screwed. Ben, so next time you listen to me or I walk. Silence. She bites her lip. I feel the heat flush my face. My hand is white around the barrel of the rifle. Then she says, we all know you prefer to fly. I walk over to the controls, disgusted with her, but I can't argue with her statement. She's right there. The controls of the Cherub help to set me right. It's where I belong, after all. It's what I'm good at. I power up the engine, turning her back to Apple Pie. It's a stupid name, of course. But leave it up to a bunch of scientists to name something, and they'll come up with something Latin or something cute. Apple, after the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and the one that fell on Newton's head. Pie, after the constant, and a groaner of a pun. I try not to say it too much. Apple pie makes me itchy, too. The place, I mean. It's also on the ground. My stomach yawns, and I reach over for the hunk of sausage I left on the console. It's one of the few perks of the job. It's what attracted me to Miranda's proposal in the first place. The boffins are better at feeding me than I am. That's what I call Miranda's lot. I read it in a book once, and it stuck. The salty, peppery meat, pigeon I think it is, goes down easy and helps to patch up my mood. The food thing was something of a surprise. I mean, I wouldn't have pegged scientists for being good with food, but in the kind of communes Miranda grew up in, they learned this stuff. How to salt and preserve meat. How to grow vegetables and fruits without fields. I guess it all makes a kind of sense. Keeping food is really all about bacteria. There's enough of them that know about biology that they had it sussed. The end result is that I eat better than most, and that's one of the things that keeps me coming back. The others, well, like I said, I'm still deciding. I push the engines to a comfortable clip, suddenly wanting to get back to the core. That's what I call apple pie. It sits better with me, partially because it's the center of everything in the boffin's activities, but also because of the apple thing. There's not so much to sink your teeth into in the core of an apple, but it does contain the seeds. Whether those seeds will actually grow anything, though, that's always a gamble. I may have just eaten, but I feel the need to eat more, almost as if that will justify everything. Why I put up with all this mucking about with the ferals. Why I carry their blood on my ship. Why I put up with Miranda. Right now, she's making notations in her battered notebook. I once took a peek inside and couldn't tell anything other than some of the scrawl was letters and some of it was numbers. She has abysmal penmanship. Mine is much better, but then Dad drilled that into me, insisted on me learning reading and writing. Doesn't always come in handy here in the sick, but it made him happy. And it helps when I come across any old books, which isn't often, but happens occasionally. And really, ferals can't read, so that makes me feel somewhat more human. Yep, full speed back to the core, and I can divest myself of Miranda, at least for a little bit, and get some clear air and food. With those and a good pistol at your side, you don't need much else. Well, those things in a good ship to fly. I've gone days without food, but the Cherub has always been there for me, has always lifted me to safety, has always been my home. She may not be much to look at, not with the way she's been fixed up and jury-rigged over the years, but she's as much family to me as my father was. She's safety and freedom and, dare I say, love. That's why, as the Corps comes into sight, I realize that it will never truly feel right to me. It will never feel like home.
Do you have a problem? Would you like someone to solve it? Would you like someone to share in your misery? Now, I don't know the answer, but I know a flamenco dancer who will dance for you. If you will dance for me, her name's Miranda. She's a Rudolph Valentino fan, and she doesn't claim to understand. She bakes brownies for the boys in the band.
You've been listening to the opening segment from the Falling Sky. This
Saturday night is the memories that it gave. She's busy in the pantry, far away from Elmer Gantry, who is busy baking souls that he may save. Everybody saw that Miranda. She's a Rudolph Valentino fan, and she doesn't claim to understand. She bakes brownies for the boys in the band. The dice of death are calling, while the truck of time is falling, by the thumb stuck out on the highway of the years. The toll gate at the turnpike is ignored by those who hitchhike, and the Howard Johnson food is made of fear. But not Miranda. She's a Rudolph Valentino fan, and she doesn't understand. She bakes brownies for the boys in the band. The sunburned skin is peeling on the doctors who are healing, and the license plates are laughing on the car. The pain is so exciting, and everyone's inviting you to look upon their operation scar. But not Miranda. She's a Rudolph Valentino fan, and she doesn't claim to understand. She bakes brownies for the boys in the band. The arguments are clashing while commercial planes are crashing.
Well, you will find no greater Phil Oakes fan than I, except for a few other people. But it's a long song, and I had to go with it for the namesake.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. It was that I was thinking of Comfortably Numb.
Oh, huh. Yeah.
As another possibility. There aren't that many pandemic songs out there. What's the difference between a pandemic and an epidemic?
I actually don't know for sure, but I think it's like an epidemic is more narrowly focused, whereas a pandemic is, you know, it just spreads everywhere.
Mm.
That's my non-informed thought about that.
That sounds right, though. Yes. It does sound right, and it's a thing that came into my head when I was reading the Connie Willis book, which deals so much with that. If you would like to call up and speak with Raj Khanna about his work, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And for this portion, and there are calls, you'll need them headphones. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
The difference is, sir, by the way, your last name is Khanna?
Khanna, yes. Khanna.
May I just ask, is that Indian?
It is Indian, yes.
What part of the country, may I ask?
My father was from his family's from a part of India that is now Pakistan, but it's
Bengal?
Punjabi.
Punjabi.
Yeah.
I just finished reading a marvelous Punjabi epic translated into English for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Pandemic is global. The Spanish influenza of 1918 was pandemic because it took place in Europe, Asia, and the United States. Just as the Black Death, most people don't realize, did not start in Europe. It started in the Far East.
Yeah, in Asia.
But it took 10 years to get there. Anyway, you mentioned Zelazny. And Zelazny was one of those very few people who knew how to keep a series going. I always worried when I saw a book that said on the cover, this is the 38th volume of the trilogy.
Not that willingly. Roger did not want to do 10 books.
He didn't want to do 10?
No, he wanted to do 3. He had a trilogy in mind, and it was selling so well that they said, make it 5.
Well, I'll tell you.
And then the follow-up books, which you would not know are, in fact, almost seamlessly integrated into the first quintology.
Right.
That he intended to be 5 in order to match the first. But his druthers would have been 3. And I said, so why did you make it 5? And he said, I've got a lovely swimming pool.
Well, I will say this. He's one of those few writers who knew what he was doing. There were writers who should have quit while they were ahead. Anyway, I've always liked the name Mr. Connor Miranda, whether it was Star Trek, Shakespeare, or your novel.
Thank you.
There are 2 Zelazny books that I like very much. They're kind of standalones. One is a very short book because it only has 31 little chapters. The one that takes place in a graveyard, which is an homage to every horror film ever made. I think it's called 31 Days in October. Very little book. The other is a series, I think only 2 books came out, which is an epic in every sense of the term, a conflict between St. Michael and the devil for possession of the earth.
That he co-wrote with Sheckley.
That is a fun book. That's a fun series.
Fun is right, but I wouldn't put it among his better books.
No, but it's certainly worth a read.
Oh, if it has his name on it, it's worth a read, but I wouldn't put it in his upper echelon.
No. I certainly would put it Lord of Light. Or anything of that.
Or even Jack of Shadows.
No, that's true.
Doorways in the Sand.
The other thing, of course, about Zelazny is, of course, The Last Defender of Camelot. Oh, one of my favorite stories. Yes. Your book, Mr. Khanna, is it intended to be part of a series?
I don't know if I'd call it a series, but it's so I've planned 3 books, I guess, like Zelazny, but I, you know, at the moment, that's about all I'm planning on. And right now, I was only under contract for the 1 book, but I'm hoping that I'll be able to do the next 2.
Well,
yeah, these, by the way, we mentioned that they're from Pyre Books,
right,
PYR.
Right.
And the first title is again Falling Skies?
Falling Sky, singular.
Oh, Sky, not like the
not like the TV show.
Not
right?
Like the TV show.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Well, keep up the good work, and let's hear from you more in the future.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your call.
Okay, and again, the phone number, there were other calls, but we have a weird phone system here, and they drop off after a number of rings. They just got gotten rid of. Maybe ringing in their home, but not here. But the number here is 212-209-2950. Hard science fiction. Not necessarily what everybody's writing today.
This? I mean...
It's.
I don't know if I'd call it hard science fiction in the sense that even though it's grounded in, you know, like the virus is grounded in real viruses and things like that, I think The Airships lends it almost like a hint of almost a fantastical element. I mean, I tried to make it as real as possible.
Well, but that's the more Burroughs science fantasy kind of a thing.
Right.
But it's still science fiction.
It is, and which is not something I tend to write more fantasy than science fiction.
Yeah, I know that from your short stories.
Yeah, so, I don't know. You know, the genesis of this came from when I was at Clarion West in 2008, and I had...
I once had one person as a guest on this show who was not at Clarion.
Well, actually the short story I read when I appeared at the Nursif reading last year, I guess it was.
Yeah, it was Fran Wilde.
Was the inspiration for this. And, you know, I basically wrote that 1 week there, and everyone said, you should make this world novel. And so I used that as a springboard and eventually wrote this. But so I guess the genesis was a little bit unusual in that it came out of desperation. You know, the need to write a story for that week. Mm-hmm. Originally, when I went, I took a few, you know, ideas that were just like a couple sentences in a bunch of different files just to give me inspiration. And this one was basically about a guy who wakes up on a floating ship. I mean, nothing quite as advanced as the ones in the book, but, you know, after having drunk too much the night before and realizing he had to go down to the ground and being afraid to go down there. And I didn't know what he was afraid of. I didn't know why he had to go down. I didn't know who he was. And it was Paul Park, who was our first week instructor, who, you know, he asked me what...
Who was our last reader at Nursif.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. And
no, 2 months ago. Sorry, a month before ago. Last.
And he...
It's tomorrow, yeah.
He said, well, you know, what are you working on? So I told him about it, and he said, well, you don't want to have that be a fantasy. Like, everyone's in their own little ship in the cloud. And I was like... At that point, I had no idea. I thought it could be fantasy, could be any. And I said, no, of course not. It's going to be science fiction. And so that helped me go in that direction. So,
Yeah. And it's a good direction to go. Science fiction, which I call everything science fiction. You know, I use the, you know, speaking of Clarion, the Damon Knight definition of science mm-hmm. fiction, which is science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Right.
It's a very, you know, strict kind of definition. And, but there is, of course, one uber genre that includes Tolkien.
Right.
As well as Asimov.
Right.
Any hard science fiction. But hard science fiction is, when you take a look at the various podcasts, a lot of the stuff that is coming out, what is popular within speculative fiction tends to be, there are many words for it, slipstream, interstitial, unclear, if it's real, unreal, weird stories, or straight out and out fantasy.
Sure.
But science fiction has become sort of a poor cousin in its own genre to a certain extent. Ben Bova has a book coming out, Ben Bova and Eric Choi, that's nothing but hard science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
17 stories. And I'll be interviewing both editors, Eric Choi and Ben, about it next week.
Okay.
Doing a Skype. I hate doing Skype interviews, but I'll be recording that. And that's coming out in December. And I just thought that was an interesting choice to root your work in a fun, adventuresome, almost as adventurous as the kind of stuff people find in Beneath Ceaseless Skies, which is a very good... is it online only, isn't it?
Yeah.
Zine.
Although they do, I think, best ofs every year. So,
oh, okay.
Maybe every couple of years.
Yeah. Which is all adventures. And a lot of that tends to be fantasy. A great deal of that is fantasy.
Yeah, I think my approach, especially to novel-length works, is to try and jam a bunch of different things that I like together. So, you know, this one I think of as a blend of science fiction. There's a little, you know, there's the airships thrown in there. There's a little bit of, you know, zombie-like horror. There's a little bit of, you know, thriller-type pacing. So, and it's not like I set about to, like, mix these things up, but it just tends to come out when I do stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully it's still new and fresh for people when they read it.
Are you intending on writing the two follow-up books first and then moving on to something different, or is that a question of the market, or?
I tend to work on multiple projects at a time. So right now I've actually done some work on a follow-up, and also I'm working on a YA novel at the same time, which is something I started before you know, before the book even sold. So I try to keep, I find that one of my easiest ways to combat procrastination is to use another project so that when I don't feel like working on one, I work on the other. So I'm hoping, actually, it's a little ambitious, but I'm hoping to have my next two projects finished by the end of the year, and then I'll probably start another two projects. So,
how much writing do you do a day?
It varies. My most recent process has been to try and wake up 2 hours before I start work. And I work from home, so I don't really have a commute right now. And then try to get as much writing done as possible in that time period. Sometimes it's, you know, 500 words. Sometimes it's 2,000 words. Sometimes it's, you know, two paragraphs, depending. But at least I'm getting a little bit of progress every day. It used to be weeks would go by, I wouldn't do anything, and I'd do, like, you know, a couple weeks of heavy writing. And I'd rather just do it on a regular basis.
Are you one of those people that tweet how many words you've written every
day? No, I mean, I actually...
No offense, because I really, really love some of the writers who do it. I love their work. But, I mean, I really don't need to... Oh, look, you know, here's a blah, blah, blah. A favorite writer of mine has said something on Facebook or Twitter or something like that, and I just wrote 2,700 words in umpteen hours. And it's like, were they good words?
Right. I mean, and I think that's always the case. But I think for some people, it's a useful metric so that they can see how they're doing. And if they, you know, I know some people, if they don't hit a certain threshold.
Put it in a diary.
Yeah,
I mean, to read it.
Although that makes you accountable to the public, I suppose. You know,
I guess that's part of what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you see, they don't write on there. It would be another thing if they wrote, I failed to get any writing accomplished today, which I had hoped to do. Instead, it's more like, ta-da! I've done this.
Yeah. I guess we all have different ways to kind of cheerlead ourselves sometimes, because writing is so lonely and a lot of the time. And
yeah, it is.
You know, you don't get immediate gratification. You might get the satisfaction of having completed 1,000 words, but there's nobody saying, good for you. So sometimes you need to kind of reach outside to get, I guess, that kind of feedback of you know, positive feedback, I guess, for doing that.
And I assume that's also something that the writers group gives you.
Yeah, although, I love my writers group, and it's definitely great to have that. We, you know, it does... I mean, we're focused on short stories, so it does kind of give you that motivation of wanting to get more out, especially when you see other people, you know, pushing stories through the group. It does get that. I guess it helps those juices to flow a bit.
See, I love one thing about that, is that as your writer's group continues to go, so many of the original members of the group are now writing very successful novels.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they have to present short stories to the group rather than here's my latest chapter, I think it's good. Keeps them honest.
You know? I mean, it's also nice just because
I love the craft of the short story.
I mean, and the length involved in a novel sometimes, you know, it takes so long for it to see the light of day since you started working on it. You know, one of the things a short story does is at least it gives you, you know, a way to complete something a lot quicker, and then you can send it out and actually see progress as it comes back or gets bought or whatever. And you can also try things in a short story that, you know, not that you would never get away with in a novel, but you can test things out, try new things without risking a whole, you know, 80 to 100,000 words on. So
yeah. Well, speaking of completing things, this is a horrifying thing to say, but we're actually out of time.
That's too bad.
It really is. So where do people find you online?
My website is basically my name, so it's rajankhanna.com, RajanKhanna.com. And people always try to make it K-A-H, but it's actually K-H-A.
As in the wrath of...
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, with an A on the end.
Yeah, or an N and an A.
Oh, a Na. The Wrath of Na.
Or, I mean, on Twitter, I'm Rajanyk. So
yeah, that's one. Yeah, what you need to do is you go to Twitter and you type in your full name, Rajan Khanna, and then people will see what your Twitter name is. I can't ever remember it. The book is Falling Sky, singular, thank you very much, from Pyre Books.
Yes.
In print now, actually print, actually a hard copy.
Yes, although there is also an ebook if you prefer that.
Yeah, and it's a good read.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here. I'm so pleased that this has happened.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, and we'll do it again soon.
Oh, great.
Okay. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Next week, I believe our guest is Sally Wiener-Grotta. And the week after that, NK, which will be Thanksgiving Eve morning, we will be giving thanks to Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, for being here. And more to come. Oh, yes. Recorded interview, somebody named Anne Rice. That's just in progress now, that interview. So, yeah, couple of folk. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister. Good morning.
the place is well hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother in it. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Down.